Happy holidays and new year from all things Trek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
So, I feel like a little bit of a traitor.
Oh, really?
Because I've got something to admit.
Well, we won't judge you here, Bob. Oh, I will, but maybe our listeners won't.
So, as a lot of people know, I play Star Trek Online. Uh-huh. Or, you know, perhaps did. We'll find out here in the future whether or not that it will be past tense or not.
Ooh.
But I picked up, over the holiday season, since our last episode, Star Wars The Old Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, boo! Yes! No, I'm just kidding. I love Star Wars. Anyway.
Now, I've played a lot of MMOs. I don't know how many MMOs you've played in the past.
I have played two. I played two. EverQuest and World of Warcraft.
All right. Well, you've, I think, gotten a pretty good look then at probably the MMO world if you've played both of those.
Well,
EverQuest,
I mean,
being one before World
I've
of Warcraft.
I've played others for about 15 minutes. Those are the only two that,
doesn't
I
count.
Ever, those are the only two that I ever actually leveled a character in seriously.
All right. So, you remember the Star Trek... Or no, Star Wars is Star Trek times 100 from crack.com, right?
Yes, I do.
For those that haven't seen this, we actually mentioned this on an episode, might have been the last episode we did just before Christmas season.
It's weird. The week break really messed up like my sense of time.
So mine too. I don't even know what's happening here. Anyway, there's this crack.com picture, which is Star Wars is Star Trek times 100 is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I really gotta say, that holds very true with Star Wars The Old Republic. Mostly because it's from BioWare.
Oh, goodness.
They did such a good job with their storytelling and whatnot.
Really?
Yes.
See, I
it's like you played Mass Effect and like Dragon Age Origins, though, right?
Right, but like I wasn't expecting it because BioWare is really good at making single-player RPGs.
Well, that's the point I'm going to get to. But first, what I want to mention is that they did a really good job making sure that it all fits in an MMO premise and that grouping with other people still fits with like your character story and all that stuff. Now,
okay.
A lot of the game does... a lot of it encourages you to play single player because you have your companion that's with you, which you have a whole crew of companions like you would collect in like Mass Effect or Dragon Age Origins, for instance, where you only have one with you at a time. It's not like a whole party.
Oh, that's
with
too
you.
Bad.
Yeah, but the rest of them like hang out on the ship and you can send them off to do things like, you know, gather materials or send them on missions where you have them collect stuff for you. My favorite one is slicing, where it's literally slicing is fantastic. What you do is you you tell your companion, all right, here's what I want you to do. Somewhere out there is a box. It's full of money. I want you to bring this box of money back to me.
Go get that box.
That's what slicing
it's
is.
It's got stuff in it that I want.
Yeah, but they did such a fantastic job with the storytelling aspect of it. And each class has their own story that you go through, that you play through. I mean, it's going to be the same for every player that plays that class. Keep that in mind. But still done in a very, very awesome cinematic way. And I initially thought that fully voiced over... a fully voiced MMO wasn't really going to make that big of a difference. I gotta say, it makes a huge difference.
Well, if
it draws
use,
me
like...
in much more. Because usually what happens is I play MMOs for a while, and it's like that kind of comes, you know, very routine and whatnot. Then typically then I put something on the background, like a show or something like that, while I'm playing an MMO.
You have something to entertain you while you're working.
Yeah, exactly. I don't feel that way, actually, with The Old Republic, which is really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, all
now,
right.
Now,
what
I want to illustrate... really quick between Star Trek Online, excuse me, and Star Wars: The Old Republic, which I think actually goes back to how both of these IPs have been presented to us over the years, is that Star Wars is much more of a singular character epic story. I mean, you still have lots of characters, but most of it centers on, like, for the first three movies, I'm talking the ones from the 70s and 80s,
the ones that we care about.
Yeah, Luke Skywalker. We're very much.
Yeah.
Looking at his story and his transformation from being a farm boy into epic galactic hero.
Well, Star Wars has always been, at its heart, a very, very well-executed version of the hero myth.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say next. Whereas we look at Star Trek, it's very much about taking a group of characters or a select few of characters. I mean, there are good character piece episodes, like Soldiers of the Empire, which we're going to talk a little bit about today.
Yeah.
And expanding on them, but more dealing with how they interact in certain situations from a week-to-week basis, right? And looking at more of a broader scope of what the world is like, because they're dealing more with social issues as opposed to the journey of one character.
This is true.
Right, and that's where I think the huge difference is between Star Trek Online and The Old Republic, as MMOs go. Star Trek Online is trying desperately to make your character an epic character in a setting that is really much more about the broader implications of smaller actions that people are taking, but it's not executed very well. Whereas the Old Republic is taking that idea of single character epic and running with it. Like, I can't tell you how well they run with it, too, because BioWare does some pretty damn good storytelling.
Okay.
I mean, especially with things like Mass Effect and Dragon Age Origins on their resume.
That's true.
So,
I have to admit,
as far as MMOs go, I think BioWare did a really good job. I'm actually enjoying the Old Republic more than I've been enjoying Star Trek Online recently.
Well, I mean, I have to admit, I was really skeptical about Star Trek Online. I'm basically about Star Wars Old Republic. But maybe I will have to give it a try. I mean, it seems I've been hearing a lot of good things, so maybe I'll have to eat my words. But anyway.
Well, it's an MMO. It's going to be $15 a month.
Ew.
Keep that in mind. Whereas, like, Star Trek Online is going free-to-play in 17 days.
So that's true.
So, but again, just because that I have to pay $15 a month for Star Wars probably doesn't mean that I don't want to play it, though.
That's fair.
Because I really feel like I've gotten some good value out of the Old Republic so far, despite the fact I'm not even at level cap yet. Like, I'm not even raiding or anything like that yet.
So this is
I've done some PvP and whatnot, which I think is really fun. I think they did pretty good on that. I mean, it's not really all that different from what World of Warcraft has been this with, but the PvP is also voiced. So, like, a good example is they have a mode called Hutball, which is there's two goal lines, and there's a ball in the middle. And you have the Imperials on one side and the Republic on one side.
Yeah.
And which the teams are called the Frog Dogs and the Rotworms.
Oh, my goodness.
The Frog Dogs, as far as I can tell, are always Republic, and then the Rotworms are always Imperials. I play Republic, by the way. I'm a trooper.
I have to admit, Frog Dogs makes me want to play this game more than I do.
But there's an announcer guy, and there's, like, this opening spiel where there's, like, a hut, like, not Jabba the Hutt, but there's a hut that's, you know, sponsoring the game and whatnot.
Right.
The announcer, and he'll go through and, you know, say, like, oh, man, that Rotworm got creamed by the Frog Dogs or whatever, if, like, a Frog Dog, you know, like, totally destroyed a Rotworm player or something like that.
Yeah.
And, like, not quite with the same emphasis as, like, a Mexican soccer announcer necessarily, but every time they score, be like, oh, man, they scored, you know, stuff like that. It's very entertaining, and I really like it. It adds a lot of character, I feel, to the MMO that wasn't otherwise there.
Well, that's fair. All right, just to take this tangent even more off course from what we normally talk about, do you think that MMOs are intentionally being released under the idea of they will charge a monthly service for the first, like, year to make up their development costs, and then the game will go free-to-play to appeal to a wider audience? Because I've been noticing that trend more and more, and it's always been, like, portrayed as this game is failing. Let's make it go free-to-play and try to draw in more viewers or more players. Do you think maybe that's something they're starting to do intentionally now?
I think that's a very, very complicated, big question to answer.
Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack in there. For instance, with Star Trek Online's development, it's been rumored anyway that initially Cryptic wanted to release it as a free-to-play game.
Just straight up?
Just straight up free-to-play. But Atari said, no, we want to make this a monthly pay-to-play game. But, you know, I don't have a problem with free-to-play games as long as you're giving me the content I expect for a monthly pay-to-play game.
Right.
Right? So, whereas free-to-play, I'm a little more leery of those, specifically because ones I've played in the past typically have content locks, where you need to buy the specific content that you want to play. Now, in the case of Star Trek Online, what they want to do is make sure that all the content is available for you to play, but they're still gating you in other aspects. Now, I can totally start from level 1 and go to level 51, which is Vice Admiral, which is the highest level you can get right now in the game.
Right.
By using nothing but drops that you get in-game and not buying a single friggin' thing off of the C-Store, which is their cash shop, right? Mm-hmm. Now, how it's going to be, though, is as soon as you get to Vice Admiral now, you're going to have to buy that Vice Admiral ship, that Tier 5 ship. So,
okay.
I don't know if you can actually do the content that's at Vice Admiral, which would be akin to, like, raid-level content and other MMOs, with captain level ships. I just don't know. I haven't tried it myself. I typically am trolling around in my
your Excelsior.
Yeah, my Excelsior, which can kill a sophomore at 30 paces. Or my Galaxy class if I really feel like tanking it up. I promise you that there's a galaxy underneath those particle effects somewhere.
Yeah. For those of you who didn't listen to previous episodes, that's an in-joke, because when Bob is playing as Excelsior, he fights like 50 Klingon ships at once, and they're hitting him with so many different like animations and attacks that you can't see his ship.
He's just
constantly cycling through his healing and tanking abilities, so his ship just doesn't die. There's just this big glowing ball of special effects, and there's a ship in there somewhere.
You see lasers coming out every once in a while.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway.
I don't think the Old Republic is going to go free-to-play. I just don't see it doing that because, one, the way it operates is very much akin to World of Warcraft.
Right.
As much as I really kind of dislike that aspect of it, because we're dealing now with, like, blasters.
Ah.
Right. And as, that was one of the things, one of my problems with Star Trek Online when I was first playing, is like, yeah, phasers, you know, you're down, right?
Yeah.
Whereas now they got, like, health bars and shield generators and stuff that regenerate and stuff. It's kind of like, eh. I mean, kind of something that changed a little bit was the 4.0 patch, or Season 4, as they call it, where ground combat got a little bit faster and such. So, I don't know. I think, as to the original question, I think they really don't try to intentionally, from the start of production, go, this is going to be free-to-play or this is going to be pay-to-play. I think they go with one or the other right off the bat is what they try to do. And then depending which way the wind is blowing, they'll change or stay with whatever they got going on.
Okay. Well, this is actually making me want to do a separate podcast about MMOs, but we do, in theory, have some Star Trek to talk about. So at 10 minutes into the podcast, we are finally going to get to talk to about our main topic for today, which is Klingons. And this came about, originally we were going to talk about something else, but this came about because I spent like an hour or 2 hours arguing with Jim, who was on the show last time, about Klingons.
Talking about the Mirror Universe.
Yeah,
Now, his introduction to the Star Trek universe, as we mentioned last episode, was through me, through the Mirror Universe.
Yeah.
Because I remember talking about Star Trek several times during high school, and a lot of my friends just weren't into it. They just weren't into Star Trek. They were more into like Star Wars or more dark, gritty, future type stuff.
Oh, I've been there. In like middle school, that's what like people teased me about, was that I was into Star Trek and not Star Wars.
Well, we just didn't care though, because we were Star Trek fans and whatnot.
All the way.
All the way. Well, I'm still a Star Wars fan as well. I've got no problem with Star Wars.
My answer for whenever anyone said, but Star Wars would beat up Star Trek in a fight, and I'd say like, oh yeah, Star Trek has Q. He'd just snap all your Star Destroyers away, and wouldn't you feel silly?
Just remember what happened in the Jem'Hadar and the wormhole too.
They were not impressed.
They weren't.
But anyway, continue.
Yeah, so his introduction to Star Trek was through the Mirror Universe. So I think I should say a little bit about what he thought about, anyway, as for, you know, how to problem solve, at least with the episode that you guys were talking about on Facebook. Oh, it's getting the conversation a little bit.
It's a long conversation.
It is. 96 comments is pretty long for me on a Facebook post. But you guys were talking about Soldiers of the Empire.
Yeah, what I decided was that we were going to do the podcast on Klingon, because that way I could pretend like this two-hour-long conversation I'd had on Facebook was research and brainstorming instead of just wasting my time.
Jim, or Oren, you're arguing on the internet.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to make it productive. So anyway, Klingons. So we have them first, obviously, in TOS. They were in seven episodes of TOS, and at first they were basically just sort of like an analog for the Soviet Union, and at the same time they were a vessel for all of humanity's negative traits. Because if you recall, in TOS, they kept talking about humans had evolved beyond their negative traits, so like they put all those on the Klingons. And the Klingons are aggressive, they're sneaky, they are, you know, ironically, they are dishonorable. They have no, or at least very little, interest or care in life other than themselves. And they're always looking to expand their territory. And then just visually, they're kind of dark-skinned and vaguely foreign-looking. So, if you remember the original Klingons, they didn't have the forehead ridges or anything. They were just regular people.
They were literally just dark-skinned.
Yeah.
People.
Vaguely. In fact, apparently the only direction in the script for what Klingons were supposed to look like was vaguely Asian. Like, that's, like...
Really? Did it say that?
I read this on Memory Alpha, which doesn't necessarily mean it's true. There's a lot of weird stuff
Memory Alpha's a wiki. Let's keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't necessarily mean it's true, but that's what I've been... what's been indicated to me is that the original script didn't have a whole lot of guidelines on what the Klingons were supposed to look like. And because the makeup at the time was very limited, the makeup director just went with, all right, we're going to give them this gold lame for their outfits, and then we're going to, you know, darken their skin a little bit. And then, of course, some of the actors already had dark skin, and then, of course, in certain episodes, that's not true. Like, in Trouble with Tribbles, all the Klingons are white. But in most episodes, the Klingons are clearly either, like, Asian or maybe African-American sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So they were they were a little racist, but it was the 60s. Everything was a little racist. but even so, in most episodes, like in Errand of Mercy, which is the first episode they show up in, that's the one where they go to Organia, and it's like, it's supposed to be a big anti-war episode, but it's still pretty clear that the Klingons are the bad guys. Even though war itself is being condemned, it's clear that the Klingons are the ones starting it.
They're the instigators in this scenario.
And then you have, let's see, what other episodes were they in? There's also, like, there's Friday's Child and Private Little War, which is, again, just another really clear example of how the Klingons were analogs for the Soviets, because they were attempting to influence a much smaller, minor power against the Federation. I don't know if they were actually being called the Federation yet by
that
point. It
was so minor, though.
Right, but it was sort of,
you know... the scale of what we're talking about here would literally, like, be us going to, like, the Amazon and, like, going to where the grass huts are near the river and going, hey, check this out, we've got this really cool thing.
Well,
that's kind of it.
Bob was miming handing someone a musket.
Yeah.
But it was a little more than that, because both of those planets had resources that the Federation and the Klingons both wanted. So it was a little... But it was, you know, it was a very clear parallel to, you know, the Soviets and the Americans, you know, fighting over countries in Southeast Asia. Although, ironically enough, that was more China than the Soviet Union. But we, you know, that didn't really enter the public imagination so much until later. We all saw the Soviet Union as this big enemy. And later did we find out that China and the Soviet Union weren't such close buddies as we thought. Apparently there was actually significant fear in the Chinese military that the Soviets would try to invade. They put a lot of heavy fortifications along their northern border because they were concerned about that. But anyway, we're drifting off topic here.
No, that's very on topic, I think.
You think so?
Well, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's also...
Considering that we're in the 60s Star Trek era right now, mm-hmm. we're talking about Klingons being like the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and the Romulans are kind of like the Chinese in the way that they're...
Really?
Yeah, I mean, even though they're actually kind of Roman, they're you know, in their ranks and the way they dress, they are sort of portrayed as the Chinese. If you think about, like, Asian stereotypes at the time, the Romulans are very sneaky, they have their cloaking device, they're weird and exotic in a way that the Klingons aren't. Because they look, you know, they're like Vulcans, and Vulcans are elves, and elves are Asians, is sort of how this stereotyping progresses.
Mm-hmm.
So the Romulans are sort of a China analog, and the Klingons are sort of a Soviet Union analog, which is also why they're kind of allied in the original series, a little bit. And, like, because I'm sure a lot of people already know that, like, they originally dropped and broke the model for the Romulan ship. So in the second episode,
are you serious?
Yeah, I've talked about this on the
Man.
Podcast before. You know, the original.
I remember us talking about the ambassador one being dropped, which didn't actually turn out to be true.
Yeah, that's not true. But no, the Romulan model, the model for the Romulan ship that they used in the first Romulan episode, which was I can't remember the name.
Balance of Terror.
Balance of Terror. Yeah, that between that and the next episode of the Romulans appeared, which was the Enterprise incident. That model was somehow destroyed. I'm not positive if it was actually dropped, but I know there was an accident and it was too badly damaged to use. They didn't have the budget to make a new one, so they
take the Klingon ship.
Yeah, so they had them using Klingon ships, and they threw in some dialogue about how the Klingons and the Romulans had allied. Which, you know, was an interesting twist, and that just sort of further played up how the Klingons and the Romulans were sort of analogs to the Soviet Union and China. And then it's not until the Day of the Dove in the Soviet excuse me, not Soviet Union.
In the Soviet Union with the Day of the Dove.
In Soviet Union, Star Trek's you.
Oh my goodness.
But no, in Day of the Dove in the original series was the first episode where the Klingons were portrayed as anything other than straight up villains. And Day of the Dove, for those of you who don't remember, is the episode where they bring up some Klingons who had like crash landed, I think, off of a planet. And then, like, the tensions start to like, amp up and like, get higher and higher. And Chekhov is going on and on about how the Klingons killed his brother, even though it's revealed he doesn't have a brother. And, like, McCoy has this really, really uncomfortable speech where he yells about how much he hates Klingons. And everyone's, like, really quiet in the turbo lift afterwards. And you can tell they're just thinking, man, McCoy's a bit of a racist.
He is a good old
and of
country,
course,
country
doctor. Yeah, and the Klingons are also getting really mad. And at first you think that's just because they're Klingons. But then... it's revealed that there's actually an entity on board that's like feeding on all of their negative emotions. And so they have to, the Klingons and the Federation have to like sort of unite and deal with that. And it's like, oh, look, maybe the Klingons are capable of doing something other than fighting good guys. Maybe. And I think that was actually the last episode that the Klingons featured in prominently. Cause there were a couple of others where like, they were just sort of nameless bad guys. Like in the episode, what was it called? Ilan of Troyes. They were there, but they weren't really anything other than, like, a mysterious ship that was, like, opposing them. We never actually saw a Klingon in that episode, as far as I recall. So Day of the Dove was, I think, the last time we actually saw a Klingon in the original series. And I could be wrong about that, but it's at least it was one of the later times.
And so what was it exactly about the Klingons that made them the Soviet Union parallel exactly? Like, what were the exact traits that were mirrored in the series?
Well, it was more just the role that they were in of, like, the opposing... At first, the Klingons were just sort of the opposing superpower, was the idea. Was that, like, Earth or the Federation, depending on what point in the series you were in, were, like, the good guys. And even though they were multicultural, they were clearly supposed to be America. And, like, originally, the USS just stood for United States Ship. Like, they made that pretty clear. And then they changed it to, I think, United Spaceship when they realized that this was supposed to be a multinational organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Klingons are the opposing superpower. They are clearly the more aggressive superpower because this show was made in the United States. So the Soviets are the bad guys. They do the thing like we were talking about where they're trying to win over minor planets that have things that they want and sort of spread their ideology. In Aaron of Mercy, Kor, who is the Klingon leader, he's pretty cool, even though he is portrayed as a bad guy. He has a pretty neat, like little speech where he explains Klingon philosophy. And their philosophy isn't communism. It's not that direct a parallel. But it's very clear that they are working with two organizations that have opposing philosophies on the way life should be lived. And even though the Klingons are the bad guys, there is still a little bit of a pro-peace message in all these episodes, where even though Roddenberry is portraying Soviet Union in a bad light, he's saying, well, those guys are kind of jerks, but we could totally be at peace with them.
Mm-hmm.
We could live in harmony and, like, not nuke each other. And that'd be pretty cool. And so that's, you know...
It's on my list of things that are good.
Yeah, so it's a list of things I would want. And so that's what the Klingons were all about in TOS. And so then, after TOS, you have this weird transition period into TNG and the movies. And as I recall, like, the first TOS, Star Trek the Motion Picture came out in, what, 1982?
1979.
Okay. Star Trek 2 was 1982. Okay, so we had several, and Star Trek 3 was still significantly before The Next Generation had started, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, because...
It was Star Trek 4 was the last show, I think it was the last movie we had just before TNG launched in 87, and then we had Star Trek 5 in 89.
Right. So in Star Trek 3, the Klingons show up. Technically, the Klingons showed up in Star Trek 1, but they didn't really do anything other than get vaporized by V'ger.
Yep.
interesting little fun fact. That was also the first episode, the first movie, in the first place we saw the Klingon language portrayed, and it was apparently invented by James Doohan. The guy who
James
plays...
Dune.
James Dune? It's not Doohan?
Nope.
Oh, Dune. I feel silly, but James Dune.
No, I pronounced it the same way for years until I actually figured out how to actually say it.
Well, he was the guy who played Scotty. He was the one who invented the first few phrases of Klingon. And then in Star Trek 3, they had, what was the guy's name? Oryk something.
Oryk Strawn?
Yeah, I think that might be it.
excuse me.
Yeah, Mark Orkent, that's his name.
Mark Orkent?
Mark Orkent. They had him enlarge the language, the phrases that Scotty had come up with into an actual language for Star Trek 3. And in Star Trek 3, the Klingons are, again, they're kind of cool, but they're sort of antagonists. They could have really been anybody. Could have replaced them with the Romulans very easily, or with just a rogue crew of humans.
It's like Christopher Lloyd Klingon, so good.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's especially funny because he's the captain of a ship that ends up getting used for time travel. but, like, you know, there's nothing super special about them. And it's Star Trek VI is where we see the Klingons again in the movies in a way that actually matters. Because they were in Star Trek 5 too, but let's not talk about Star Trek 5. I want to be in a good mood. So they were in Star Trek 6, and in Star Trek 6, they were really clearly a parallel for the Soviet Union. I mean,
well, I want to go back to Star Trek 3 really quick.
Oh, okay,
you don't think that the Klingons in Star Trek 3 really had much of a role at all?
Well, no. They were there.
That's when you clarify.
I maybe misspoke. No, they were there. They were very important to the story. But the fact that they were Klingons was not really a huge, important part of it.
Really? You don't think so?
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure you could have replaced...
Because here we are with... From Star Trek 2, we had the Genesis device carrying over to Star Trek 3, right?
Right.
This was, I think, literally a device that paralleled what we see in the atomic bomb. Now, it was not necessarily supposed to be like, oh my gosh, this is the atomic bomb. It's supposed to be more a commentary saying this is a weapon, or this thing that is supposed to be used for something positive, which is creating a world, can be easily turned into a weapon, just as very much as Einstein had with atomic energy. He said, yeah, we can totally use this as like an energy source, guys. And the other people were like, yeah, but can we turn it into a bomb?
how could we use this to blow stuff up?
I mean, especially if we're going to be carrying on, I mean, because we're still like in the middle of the Cold War in 1983 at this point, or 84, whatever it is, when Star Trek 3 came out, right?
Cold War,
I mean, Cold War isn't over for like another decade. It's until 91. So, I mean, we have this weapon, and then we have a captain from the other superpower who gets intelligence on this thing and goes, oh my goodness, wow, this is a thing that could be a weapon that's totally in the hands of my enemies in what is essentially their Cold War at the time. I think that's very important and is very much a commentary on what, at least, you know, what like the intelligence communities were like, I would say, during that time.
Okay.
Or just the thinking anyway as for the arms race that was occurring.
Well, that's fair.
You know, oh my gosh, they made a really cool thing. How are we going to compete against that? Well, we could go steal it. We could get the information for ourselves.
Yeah, that's fair. And you could say that's a comparison to, like, how the Russians... I forget exactly what the details on this are, but I know that the Soviet Union had spies that stole some of the data from the Manhattan Project and used it to help create their own bomb.
I can believe that. I mean, spying isn't a new thing anyway.
Right.
Or intelligence. Like, so we had the... not too long ago, I don't remember their names, but it was like literally like 2004. We had like a spy case that finally got resolved.
That case was really weird because like they had they arrested the spies and one of them.
And
it was
a guy who was giving information to Russia.
Well, it was more than one guy. There were a bunch of them, and like one of them was this lady who turned it into a modeling career. Like, because she was arrested for being a spy, and that's really hot apparently. And so now she's
This is what I'm talking about.
Now she's an underwear model.
Apparently
a very successful one, but anyway.
But I think it was important for the context of this story, especially because we still had the Cold War going on, and we still had the parallel of, you know, Klingons equals Soviet Union going on. I thought it was very important to have that in there for them to be Klingons.
Okay.
And going like, yeah, the U.S. has this really cool thing that they invented, which being, you know, the United Federation of Planets in the movie, that they want to use for good. And they realize it can be turned into a weapon, but they don't want to use it that way. Whereas their enemy is going, hey, that's a thing that they're totally going to turn into a weapon. We need that weapon.
Not a very good parallel, considering what the United States ended up doing with atomic energy. But
I'm just saying, U.S. equal good guy in Star Trek 3.
Yeah, this is true. That's true. And I see what you're saying. The main reason that I think the Klingons could have been replaced by another anyone is that
Romulans would have been really cool.
Romulans would have worked. I think it could also just been a rogue group of humans because the reason they're like their culture wasn't really that important.
Like Star Trek 2, you mean?
Yeah. Like they were, you know.
I mean that story we just did.
Yeah.
A movie ago.
I guess that's true. Thanks, Bob. But no, they're like the fact that they were Klingons like culturally didn't really come up. They didn't really act any different than humans except for like their captain was kind of a jerk.
Well, we didn't care about the Klingon culture at that point. They were the bad guys.
That's true.
That was it. We knew who the bad guys were at that point, which had already been kind of stated that, you know, at least implied, you know, they equal Soviet Union. We are fighting Soviet Union, which means we are fighting Klingons. Or excuse me, we're fighting Klingons, therefore we're fighting Soviet Union.
Yeah. And even though I find Star Trek III to be a little bit of a mediocre movie, I do really enjoy the sequence where the Enterprise is flying up on the cloaked bird of prey and they're playing, like, the aliens music in the background.
Yeah, there was a lot of that in there, wasn't there?
It was
the same composer, right?
I don't know. I assume they didn't just steal the music. I assume they had permission to use it.
I'm pretty sure it was the same composer, which if it's the same composer, I think he owned the music at that point because he's the guy who created it.
Probably.
Yeah, I don't know much about scoring movies, but...
But I really like that
James
sequence.
James Horner? Do I have that right? Is it James Horner that did Aliens?
I don't remember. I don't know the names of people. I have to... unless I write them down in the show notes, I don't know anybody's name. But, all right, I will concede the point. It was important that they were Klingons. I had not thought about it in that light. So thanks, Bob. Thanks for pointing this out to me now instead of, like, before we did the podcast. So now everyone thinks I'm a dumbass.
No, but people are entertained. It's all about the people. Right. I fight for the users.
Oh, goodness. Tron reference. All right. Everyone dig out your signed copy of Jeff. Everyone dig up your signed like Jeff Bridges picture. This is a Tron podcast now. All right. So anyway, after Star Trek III, they were kind of in Star Trek V, but who gives a crap?
I mean, and actually continue on that point.
Yeah.
A little bit. We see some of that political U.S. versus Soviet Union, a la Federation versus Klingon Empire in the beginning of Star Trek IV.
There will be no peace as long as Kirk lives.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was right there. And they were even talking about a little bit, you developed the Renegade, you know, Kirk developed this Genesis device. It's obviously a weapon that you guys have.
Which is weird because they played the clip of, like, Kirk explaining what the Genesis device was, even though that was, like, originally Marcus, Carol Marcus explaining that clip. And I don't know why they weren't allowed to use that same clip. I guess they would have maybe had to pay the actress money that they didn't have in the budget.
I believe that.
That's probably what it was. But it was really weird, because he was just saying the exact same things she had said in Star Trek II, and it was like, when did you record this, Kirk? When did you have time to record this?
Well, he was very involved with the Genesis Project.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah, he was.
He was not.
He was, though.
No, he was like, I don't think he was. I mean, what evidence do we have that he was actually involved with Genesis?
In Star Trek II, when he is trying to get in touch with Carol Marcus on the station, talking about who is taking Genesis, they can't quite talk to each other.
Well, right. That's just because she's complaining to him because she needs, like, she thinks Starfleet is going to take Genesis, and so she's calling her old boyfriend because he's the one, he's her contact in Starfleet. But I didn't get any implication that he was.
Plus,
like,
she was. What was she saying? She was asking him whether he gave the order. Now, with something as delicate as what Genesis is, being a really supposed to be like a top secret R&D project, and having only one starship assigned to it, which is the Reliant,
mm-hmm.
asking James T. Kirk, Admiral James T. Kirk, did he give the order, would have to indicate that he was involved with the project in some way, because it's the same way that military R&D works.
No. It was a trick. It was a trick, because if you remember, when Carol Marcus asked Chekhov, like, what was going on and why the Reliant was coming to take Genesis, she was like, who gave the order? And he was like, Kirk, Admiral Kirk gave the order. And that was a trick so that Marcus would call Kirk, and then Khan would, like, mess up the signal, and then, like, the Kirk would come over to investigate.
Right, but the question that he would have asked then, not at the point of who is taking Genesis, but what is Genesis?
Well, he knew what Genesis
was.
That's
what the next question would have been. Well, yeah, of course he knows, because he was involved with the project
in
some capacity.
I don't think so. I think he wasn't, maybe...
Whether it's a paper that came across his desk, or he was fully involved in the project in some capacity...
Well, okay. I will concede that as an admiral, he was probably informed about it. He was maybe the admiral in charge of, like, assigning
whether
the
he's
resources.
In the lab, I don't know.
I know he wasn't in the lab, okay? Because because David had never seen him before. So he clearly wasn't involved in a hands-on way. And also, Kirk's not a scientist. There's no reason he would have been in the lab. I could buy that maybe... He was there. He was, like, administrating, and he was, like, the admiral that they sent requests to when they needed more supplies and materials and stuff. That I could buy. That would make sense. But okay, so that had nothing to do with Klingons either. All right, we are batting a low average this episode. So after
the users,
yeah,
the users,
the users. Okay, so Star Trek VI is the next time we really see Klingons. Because again, I don't want to talk about Star Trek V.
I do a little bit.
Okay, fine.
Because it's at their worst.
We're going to talk about Star Trek 5.
I think they're at their worst in Star Trek 5.
Yeah, they are. Well, everything's at their worst
there,
in Star Trek 5.
We discussed Star Trek 5.
Okay, so anyway, Star Trek 6. And again, we have a pretty clear progression of the Klingons as a Soviet Union from, you know, Star Trek 3 to Star Trek 4, skipping 5 to Star Trek 6. And in fact, Leonard Nimoy even is reported to have said to the scriptwriter that he wanted to do the wall coming down in space. And, like, and I don't know if he actually said that, but that's something that's been attributed to him, and Leonard Nimoy was the director. Excuse me. And, of course, if there's a lot
not
of...
Not of six, he wasn't.
Yeah, he was.
No, Nicholas Meyer was.
Really?
Yes.
Are you sure?
I am absolutely positive.
Well, he was involved in the production in some way. He wasn't just the actor.
Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 6 were Nicholas Meyer.
Huh. Okay. Well, I know that Leonard Nimoy was at least very... He was heavily involved in the production process.
Nimoy did 3 and 4.
He didn't just, like, but he wasn't just acting in the movie. Maybe.
I mean, Nimoy, given the success he had with Ford, had huge say at that point in production afterwards of Star Trek movies.
Mm-hmm.
No, look, he's gonna. Howard is literally looking this up right now.
I am Googling this. I was positive that Leonard Nimoy was the director.
We're here now going to Wikipedia. Don't go to Wikipedia. Go to IMDb.
Okay, here we go. Story by Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
And so that's what
directed
it was.
By Nicholas Meyer.
Right. I mean, I was just trying to find how Leonard Nimoy was involved in the production, because I knew he was.
Yeah, Leonard Nimoy had huge pull at this point. I mean, one, because we had him coming back to Star Trek III, which he didn't really want to. I mean, we both know that after Star Trek II happened, he wants Spock to die because he wanted to be done with Star Trek at that point.
Actually, that's not true. After Star Trek II, he originally wanted Spock to die, but he really liked Star Trek II, and he thought it was really awesome, and so he actually expressed interest in coming back.
Right,
but originally
he wanted him
yeah.
to die.
Right. But it wasn't like they forced him, like, kicking and screaming back into Star Trek. Like, Leonard Nimoy
wanted
to come
back. Well,
no,
the concessions that had to be made, and he got his way, was that he had to direct Star Trek III. That was mm-hmm. one of the concessions that had to be made. And then he had to also give a lot into the story, or he wanted to give a lot into the story.
Right.
Those are the concessions that had to be made, and that gave him the pull necessary... After he had now this really awesome resume to go on for 4 and then for 6.
Okay, well, that's fair. All right. So anyway, Wall coming down in space.
Yes.
There's a big parallel between Chernobyl and the Praxis explosion.
Uh-huh.
And then you have Chancellor Gorkin, who is a big parallel for Gorbachev, I think, is his name. Was the Soviet chancellor who decided to like make peace with the West, as it were.
Was it chancellor or premier?
Yeah, premier. I don't remember what the actual Soviet rank was. I know that now it's a president of Russia.
Well, they also have a prime minister too.
Yeah, they do. And I'm a little unclear
what. I mean, I don't pay attention to the whole lot of Soviet politics, Russian politics.
I'm a little unclear like what the difference is between the prime minister and the president, because I know most countries that have a prime minister either don't have a president or the president is purely a ceremonial role. But I know in Russia, the prime minister and the president both have some kind of actual power, and I'm a little unclear who does what. I know that the president is seen as more powerful because Putin stepped down to become the prime minister after he was done being the president, then passed a law so that he could be president again.
And now it makes me wonder where the power is then.
Well, now there's a bunch of, and now there's like huge protests going on in Russia because a bunch of people don't.
Maybe
want
the prime minister would be similar to what we have in, I think it's in.
Is the Speaker of the House?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I honestly don't know.
Where it's kind of a vice presidential type-ish role.
But regardless, Gorkin is a parallel to Gorbachev. And they have this big peace deal. And then, of course, the drama is that people on both sides don't want the peace deal to happen, including Admiral Cartwright, who, as we all know, is Sisko's dad. That's great.
That actually threw me for a loop when I was first watching Deep Space Nine and saw him on there for the first time. Like, wait a minute. I went back and watched Star Trek VI. I'm like, whoa. Then I had to let go to my dad and go, Dad, why is this guy here?
It's a little.
Of course, you know, that being said, I was, you know, like, 3'7" or whatever it was at the time that was happening, but
I thought it was actually. I think it would actually be really funny if Jake's dad was actually Admiral Cartwright. Not Jake's. If Sisko's dad was actually Admiral Cartwright, and he just changed his name. Didn't tell anybody. Yeah, I mean, you know, he probably went to prison for a little while. After he got out, he changed his name and got a wife and opened a restaurant because, you know, he can't get back into Starfleet.
Oh man, I love this idea.
And that would explain why during the why he's like so against the whole like shapeshifter during the shapeshifter conspiracy they were doing blood tests on everybody.
Uh-huh.
He's like really against it, and it would be
because we found out it's the Apple Card, right? Yes.
He doesn't.
I really love this idea. I want it to be true.
I know. Okay, I'm gonna mail CBS and ask them to make this canon. But okay, anyway. So in Star Trek VI, the Klingons, it's a little weird because the Klingons don't really match the way they were being portrayed in Federation at the time. In Next Generation at the time. And I really like the Klingons in Star Trek VI. I like their outfits and they're clearly a warrior society. Like that much that they had covered, but they didn't like shout about honor all the time. Because if you go over to the Next Generation, the Klingons have been given like a complete makeover. They looked different, first of all. Like their makeup was way different from the original series.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, Worf was a member of the crew. They were allied with the Federation now. And along the way, Gene Roddenberry decided that they were going to be a warrior culture, and they were going to be all about honor and tradition. And they, even though they hadn't been anything like that in the original series. And so, you know, this leads to all the jokes about Worf and how wearing shoes on the bridge is dishonorable. Because the Klingons do...
For those that aren't familiar with that particular line, there's it's called Unaired Episodes of Season 8 of TNG. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
And it's a Twitter feed is what it is. Where is it one guy or is it a bunch of people?
I don't know. I just know it's funny.
Anyway, they're putting out different little plot lines. They're like only a sentence or two long, and that's one of them is Worf finds it dishonorable to wear shoes on the bridge.
Yeah. And so anyway, but in TNG, the Klingons talk about honor a lot. And I don't think they ever say the word honor in Star Trek VI. I don't think that ever comes up. And so it's a little weird, but I'm okay with it, especially because Star Trek VI is supposed to happen significantly before significantly before the Next Generation. And I'm willing to just...
Well, let's timeline this out really quick. We had Star Trek VI in 91.
Right.
Correct? Now, what season were we in TNG of 91? Season 4?
Season 3 or 4, because first season was 87... So, like, in theory, second season would have been 88, 89. Heck, we might even have been in fifth season by the time that came out. I don't remember exactly how the seasons worked in terms of what dates they were in. But we were in somewhere between the third season and the fifth season.
I mean, because the biggest chunk of Klingon stuff happening, I recall, was in season 4. And then just in the first episode of season 5, where we had, Legacy, Reunion.
Redemption.
Redemption's, the two-part of Redemption that happened as well, where there was a big chunk of it during season four there, where we're dealing with a lot of the politics of the, you know, Klingon Empire at that point.
Right.
Right then and there. And that, I think, coincides very well with Star Trek VI, I think.
Right.
And that's when we actually start to see the Klingon culture really take off, when they start to then start planning out Deep Space Nine, and that carries on from there.
Right. Well, yeah, especially because, I mean, when like everything in first generation, in first season, Next Generation, the Klingons were first portrayed as being kind of goofy. And Worf, of course, is portrayed as being a huge dumbass and, like, wants to shoot a hole in the view screen because Q is looking at it. But as the show went on, they became much more complicated, and the whole warrior culture thing really took off, and it was made very clear that they were all about honor. And even though Worf is probably one of the weaker characters on TNG, he does get some development, especially in Redemption, which is the Klingon Civil War. And, like, that whole thing was kind
of
cool.
One of my favorite two-parters to ever.
It's a really good two-parter.
Actually inspired me to make a mod for Starfleet Command 3.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that just sounds like fun.
Where it was, it had two Klingon factions, the Romulans and the Federation in there. So, because you only have four in Starfleet Command 3, so.
But I think one of the moving away from the movies, once we get into the Next Generation, I think one of the downsides that really came up with the Klingons in the Next Generation was that they hit the warrior-esque culture aspect so hard that it started to seem like that was all the Klingons did. Like, you know, they woke up and were warriors all day, and, like, they were born warriors and always warriors all the time, which, of course, led to jokes about, like, what would a Klingon software programmer be like? Or, like, a Klingon plumber.
Well, what are all the examples of non-warriors we see? We have Jadan from Star Trek Next Generation, Drumhead, which I think is season 5, if I remember
right. He was like a biologist or something.
Some scientist of someone we don't really care about.
Yeah, and Jadan wasn't, like, a major character or anything. So other than him, we also had a couple of Klingon lawyers.
Worf.
Yeah, I think we actually had three in the course of Star Trek. We had General Worf, who was Worf's grandfather from Star Trek VI, who was a pretty good lawyer. I mean, he managed to get the death sentence commuted in a show trial, which I think was pretty cool. And then there was the guy from, I can't remember the name of that episode now, but it's the one where Worf is being put on trial for maybe blowing up a ship full of civilians. I forget what it's called. And that guy was there. And that guy was a jerk.
He was still very much looking at it as, like, a conflict and battle, though.
Well, that was his... It wasn't actually the trial. What it was that it was an extradition hearing, because the Empire wanted to extradite Worf to be tried on Kronos.
Mm-hmm.
And so his whole shtick was that he was trying to make the Federation Admiral see that Worf was a Klingon and not a Starfleet officer.
Right.
And I felt was sort of playing on the Admiral's racism. I honestly feel like that was what he was doing, because his arguments don't really make a whole lot of sense unless you come at it from the angle that you just don't like Klingons. So, like, that's my feeling.
That's understandable, given what the relations were at the time.
Yeah.
You know, the Kimmerer cords had been severed at the time, right? The Klingons were attacking the Cardassians openly and taking space and whatnot. The Federation was like, you guys are jerks.
You guys shouldn't do that. And even though the Admiral was a Vulcan, Vulcans are clearly not immune to prejudice.
Nope.
So I think that all worked. I think that worked out fairly well. And then the other one was actually in Enterprise, and again I can't remember the name.
A lawyer?
Yeah, it was a Klingon lawyer in Enterprise, because there's an episode.
Yeah, Klingon doctor in Enterprise too.
Oh, there's that too. But there's an episode of Enterprise where it's basically just a huge rip-off.
Archer was on trial for something, right?
Yeah, it's just a huge.
We talked about this.
It's a huge ripoff of Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
Like, the entire episode plays like cuts from Star Trek VI. And, like, Archer has a lawyer who ends up going to Ruripente with him because he's, like, found in contempt of court.
Which was James Hertzler, if I remember right.
Was it? I don't remember his name. I don't remember his name or the actor.
Martok.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. But, like, so, yeah, so I really like it when we have non-warrior Klingons. But in TNG, it sort of made it look like all Klingons were warriors. And it was like,
part of that, I feel, is the way we interact with the Klingon society, which is mostly from the perspective of the Federation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially true in TNG, and a little bit in Deep Space Nine, even though Deep Space Nine is really not so much about the Federation being on the frontier exploring stuff, so much as it is trying to be, you know, like a political kind of drama, sort of, with, you know, a lot of character story and concept there and such. And With the United Federation of Planets, for instance, most of who they have out in the frontier are the exploration guys, right?
Yeah.
Case in point, the Enterprise and TOS and TNG.
Right.
They are explorers, what they are. You know, they're in Starfleet. This is an exploration vessel. They're out there exploring stuff. Well, the Klingon Empire, not so much about exploration, but more so about like conquering worlds. And Martok says that in DS9, yep. we don't embrace cultures, we conquer them. You know, like Martok says that very plainly. So it makes sense that most of the clans we would see that we would be interacting with are the warrior culture guys, right?
And speaking of that,
cast, excuse me.
This is a good segue into DS9, because I think Deep Space Nine is actually the best portrayal of Klingons. Especially, and you can notice...
Space Vikings.
Actually, I was going to say, the Klingons are clearly Space Vikings in TNG. In Deep Space Nine, what they did, and you can tell this because Deep Space Nine features Klingons in 49 episodes, which is even more than TNG. But in Deep Space Nine, they took that whole Space Viking ideal and made it more realistic. Like, the Klingons are still a very martial, I almost said mulcher, are a very martial society in Deep Space Nine, but they clearly have more going on than just all fight all the time forever. And it's not, because, like, you can't, you know, you have to be able to have some intellectual stuff going on if you run a spaceship. You can't just muscle your way through a spaceship. Like, right. You know, spaceships are very delicate and very complex devices.
Yep.
And I think Deep Space Nine did that very well, especially with the character of Martok. Martok is my favorite Klingon. Like, I love Worf in Deep Space Nine, I really do, but Martok, best Klingon ever, and I'm stealing this a little bit from SF Debris, but I think that he very well represents the balance between what a Klingon warrior is supposed to be versus what he actually is, and, like, the ideal versus the reality. And then in Deep Space Nine, we also had, in the episode Soldiers of the Empire... We met the Klingon chief engineer, and you know we got to see in other episodes that there are clearly Klingons who do things other than fight. Like fighting right. is a very important part of the Klingon society, but it is not their entire thing. Like, mm-hmm. and I thought that Deep Space Nine did that very well. And also, just Deep Space Nine did a really cool thing with Klingons, and that is the episode Blood Oath, which may have been the episode where they coined "It is a good day to die." I'm not sure. But I think that's the first time I remember hearing it. But Blood Oath did this awesome thing where they took the three big Klingons from the original series, Kor, Kang, and Koloth, from respectively Errand of Mercy, Day of the Dove, and Trouble with Tribbles, and they brought them back as older, honored warriors, Dahar Masters, they were called. And Dahar Master is just sort of the
nastiest NPCs you can ever fight in Star Trek Online.
Yeah, you basically Dahar Master is the rank you get for being sufficiently badass in the Klingon Empire. All three of them come back dressed as, you know, modern DS9 Klingons. Of course, they're very old, and they're all played by the original actors too.
Really?
Yeah, all of them. Wow, which is really cool. Like, I thought that was so awesome when I found out. And of course, the episode itself is very good, where they have to go and kill the albino because they had a blood oath.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, I was like, man, that is such awesome continuity. That is so cool. And then, of course, Kor is featured again in another episode. Actually, two more episodes. One where they go and find the Sword of Kaelas, and then the other one where he's having, like, space dementia, and he, like, dies in a glorious last stand. You couldn't see, but I was totally holding up a closed fist.
It's true, he was.
To emphasize the gloriousness of it.
Ah.
But I really think that Deep Space Nine did a lot to help Klingons. And, you know, they made just Worf, they made Worf much more interesting. And I want to talk a little bit about Soldiers of the Empire, because that was the...
That started this whole mess.
Yeah, this was the episode that Jim and I were arguing about on Facebook. And I thought about inviting him to be in this show, but then I realized we would just spend 2 hours arguing about Soldiers for the Empire. And as fun as that might be for some of you...
I would have been entertained.
I wanted to cover a little bit of a broader... thing with the Klingons. I didn't just want to talk about this episode, but I really like the episode because it shows us how the Klingon command structure is run. We have the Rotaran, which is the Martok's ship, which he's just gotten, and it's apparently a very not the best of ships. It is a sad ship. It's lost.
Well, it's just a bird of prey is all it is, but I really think it's more the crew and the assignments that they've been giving,
right,
which is making the ship really bad.
That's the point, is that the ship has lost, like, I think, like, engagements for, like, the last 7 months running. Its crew's morale is at, like, an all-time low. And we get to see what happens with Klingons when they are pushed to the breaking point, which is that they basically start to lose control. Is the idea, and they become, rather than like honorable warriors looking for combat, they turn into bloodthirsty killers, and they just need to kill something.
Such a whiny crybabies.
Yeah, and they are very whiny. and that episode did show that certain actors can talk around the prosthetic teeth better than others can. It's kind of sad when you hear a Klingon whose voice is all slurred because he's trying to talk through these prosthetic fangs.
I think, I don't remember the actor's name, but Bator from the with the Duress sisters.
Oh, Ursa.
I think she had the worst.
Let's not talk about those two. Those two are so.
Every time
lame.
She talks, I just know that she's having a hard time with the teeth.
Those two have never done anything cool. Like they were. They tried to make them. It was really weird how, like, in Star Trek Generations, they felt they needed to have a recurring villain, and instead of Tomalak, they brought in the Duras sisters. It was like, oh, yeah, the Duras sisters. I remember all the really dramatic confrontations we had with them. No, I don't, because there weren't any.
That brings up a whole different subject and topic, I think we'll talk about on a different podcast, because I feel like I could launch into a whole, tirade about that. But anyway.
All right. So, anyway, Soldiers of the Empire. And it's also, in addition to seeing, how an internal, how Klingon ship is run, and we get to see that Klingon ships aren't...
We kind of had insight into that already with Riker in season two on, what's the name of the episode?
It was, an exchange program. I don't remember the name of the episode, though.
It was Bearded season two Riker.
Mm-hmm. Which is Bearded Riker is better Riker.
Yep.
But there's... Soldiers of the Empire took us further than that, and we got to see... the sort of the nitty gritty of it. And also, I just think it's a very good character piece for Worf because he has this conflict with Martok, where Martok is making all these decisions that on the outside seem fairly reasonable to avoid combat, but he's clearly he has a deeper issue is that because he's been in a Dominion prison camp for so long, he's actually afraid to fight the to fight the Jem'Hadar. And so it takes Worf a while to realize that he has to challenge his friend and his hero for the good of the ship. And I think that's a very good character piece for both of them. And then at the end, they realize...
Well, he's also balancing two different things as well. One, he's mm-hmm. balancing the crew's need for action of some sort, victories, essentially, right? And then what he perceives as Martok's experience. Because Martok's a general.
Yeah.
Right? He's a general. It's like, you don't just get to be a general just one day.
Especially
unless you're Kirk, the new movie, which you go from cadet to captain, 48 hours.
Especially since we find out in a later episode that Martok fought his way up from, the Klingon merchant marines. He was, a freighter guy, and he fought his way up to general.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a lot of experience. I would be certainly daunted if there was someone who was above me in station of some capacity, whether that be work or social life, and they were making some sort of decision that I didn't fully understand or comprehend that I think would have some sort of benefit or greater benefit in some way that's very immediate versus what their experience is and what things will happen. And I think that's very apparent in the first bit of the episode, especially when they come across that first Jem'Hadar ship,
mm-hmm.
right? They're ship's in their sights, and Worf's ready to have them go in there and destroy the ship so they can get an easy victory, and the return will be yay, victory for them. Martok's like, no, let's not do this. This is a bad idea. Let's just let them go. And everyone's like, oh, but we could have blown them up.
We wanted to blow them up so bad.
And Worf goes to him later. It was like, General, why didn't we blow them up? They're bad guys, and it was good. Would have been easy. And his rationale is that, or Martok's rationale is that, if they blown them up, they might have gotten a message back saying, hey, we were just blown up. There's Klingons in the area. And the area would have been swarmed by Jem'Hadar patrols. And it would have been harder for them to reach their target, the Vamoth, which they were trying to rescue.
Right.
That makes tactical sense to me.
It does.
Perfectly tactical sense. May have been a decision I would have made were I a Starship commander. sometime.
So that's why I really like that episode.
It progresses later to where we actually see signs that he had been broken by the Jem'Hadar
mm-hmm.
with the second conversation he has with Worf, which is what was this? What were the circumstances of it? The Vamoth was on the other side of the border,
he wasn't willing to cross the border.
Willing to cross the border because he knew it was a trap, which turned out to be a trap anyway, because a warship came in and swooped in and all that good stuff later on.
And he was convinced they were all going to be killed, and he felt it was his mission to keep them from being destroyed.
Right.
And at all costs.
Yeah.
And that was where it really, that was really,
he even starts rambling at that point as well. Like, oh my god, blah, 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 all this stuff's gonna happen, it's gonna be terrible, we're gonna be dead, and it's, oh my god. Dishonor and all this stuff. And then that's when I think Worf finally realizes, oh my gosh, the Jem'Hadar have broken him. I got to figure out some way to make this right. Otherwise, there's going to be a huge problem. Because there was, there were problems starting to occur on the ship where that whole way of sorting out things on a Klingon ship is to, like, eliminate people above you because they're acting in ways that aren't considered, you know, proper for a Klingon to act in those situations.
Right. Like dereliction of duty. As Dax puts it, dereliction of duty or cowardice.
Right. Which Martok was definitely starting to exhibit those things more full-on the closer they got to the B'Moth.
Exactly.
You know, especially when they're right at the B'Moth, they're staring at it across the border. And when it would totally have been fine for them to go across the border, rescue the ship, engage Angem Hadar, maybe destroy them, and then come back with the B'Moth crew, and Martok didn't want to take that, you know, that chance to make that happen.
Exactly.
Totally on Klingon.
Yeah, and then Worf has to fight him, and then Worf gives him an opening so he can, you know, basically get his testicles back, as it were. And the crew is, like, you know, revved up because...
Give the general adrenaline high. That'll get him going.
Because, you know, the crew is all revved up, and they do that awesome song at the end. I really love Klingon songs.
Yeah.
But
the reason it's hard for Worf to just, from the get-go, just slap the shit out of the general and just take command of the ship...
Right.
...is because he is fighting Martok's experience as a general.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, that's not just something you can do. That'd be like us going to work and... seeing something like, for instance, I do casting, for instance, and going, okay, here's a different way we can do this, and then telling my boss, hey, there's a different way we can do this, we should do this, and then he's saying, no, let's do it this way, because it's doing us good to do it this way, and then instead of, you know, taking his advice for it, going directly to his boss above him and going, like, you know, oh, he's screwing it up.
Yeah.
That'd be like the same thing.
not something that you just do. You need a lot of motivation to make it happen.
Yeah.
So, and then of course, after that episode, we see Martok and Worf's bond grow. He becomes, you know, at the end of the episode,
Martok totally realizes what he did.
Yeah, exactly. Martok sees the wisdom of Worf's choice.
You help me get my balls back, bro.
And at the end of the episode, he's like, hey, why don't you join the House of Martok?
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to see, like, later on, spoilers, Worf, like, basically makes Martok
chancellor. I don't feel like you're spoiling much about a show that's been... off the air for 13 years.
Yeah, but spoilers. there's that really... I like how they ended up playing politics and how Worf, like, realized that Martok could not challenge Gowron to be Chancellor. He just was not in a position to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But Worf was. But Worf also knew that he couldn't be Chancellor. And so they had that really cool scene. And it also kind of played off...
I think Worf could have been Chancellor. He was just too much of a wuss.
You think so?
Yes, I do think so.
I don't think Worf had the experience to be Chancellor. I think Martok did.
So... I mean, he gave Martok the ability to be Chancellor, or he just made him Chancellor, the writers did anyway, just so I think Worf could say, you know, great people have, you know, power thrust upon them, is
what
it is.
Well, also, I think that Worf, I think it would have been weird for Worf to be Chancellor because he was a Starfleet officer, and I think that the rest of the Klingons probably wouldn't have accepted it too well if a Starfleet officer had become the Chancellor of the Empire. I think that would have been like, ooh, who's... Is the Empire run from Earth now? What's going on?
I don't know. I just think Worf has commitment issues in that regard.
I disagree. I think that Worf doesn't... I think that Martok, as a general and, like, a man who's used to commanding large, like, you know, large groups of people, as opposed to just one ship, is much better qualified to lead the Empire than Worf is. And I feel like Worf knew that. I think that's why the whole thing played out the way it did.
Yeah, I know what Worf's reasons are for it, but I mean, as per Klingon tradition and whatnot, mm-hmm. he could totally have been Chancellor.
Oh, well, yeah, he could have been.
He just wussed out on it.
All right. Well, he's the bottom line is he could have and chose not to.
He's scared of responsibility because he got rid of his son.
Oh, let's not bring up Alexander.
Oh, no, I brought up that card.
Okay, fine, Alexander. That card. God damn it. I hate Alexander's storyline so much because, like, Worf is all about honor.
Dump that kid on his grandparents.
Like, Worf is all about honor and commitment and finishing what he started. But, like, for some reason, he just decides, nope, I don't want to deal with my son. I'm going to foist him off on my foster parents. And it was so obviously because they didn't have money in the budget to have Alexander constantly hanging out. And so it was this decision that was obviously motivated by something from outside the show. And it just didn't
totally fit. But the storyline totally played out is that Worf just can't take responsibility.
But, like, he can take responsibility for everything else, and it's just weird.
Only with things that he is comfortable with, though.
Mm.
I really think that he only takes on those things that he feels comfortable taking on.
I guess. I don't know. I don't like that storyline. I like
to I mean, he seems happens. To be really comfortable being attached to the security officer. He takes those duties very seriously. Right? And then later, strategic operations officer in DS9.
True.
He does really well with those things. But he doesn't really do all that well with anything else. And he doesn't want to do anything else.
Well, he wants to command the Defiant.
Yeah, the Defiant's a warship.
Yeah, his favorite ship.
That's right in his profile. Defiant's a warship, man. Of course he wants to command the Defiant.
Right. But anyway, so after Deep Space Nine, we had Voyager. Voyager barely featured Klingons at all.
We had half Klingon Torres.
I mean, unless you count Torres. But Torres really has nothing to do with Klingon culture. There's one episode called Barge of the Dead where Torres becomes convinced that she's having visions of her mother going to the dishonorable place for the dead.
Yeah, I couldn't quite rationale that episode.
Yeah, I watched that episode and I still am not entirely certain what was supposed to be happening.
Yeah.
So that episode's weird. I'm going to skip it. It doesn't really have any bearing on Klingons.
But actually, if you carry on with the Barge of the Dead anyway, yeah. It does feature in Star Trek Online.
Really?
And it's an actual place.
Oh, right, yeah.
I think I actually mentioned this to you.
Yeah,
The Fekleri are a race. That came once upon a time, and the Klingons, like, totally shoved them back to wherever they came from. Like, they're actual aliens.
So, like, when Klingons die,
That part, I don't know. That part was never explained, the jump of that. But the Barge of the Dead is the thing, and the Fekleri are totally a thing.
That's unfortunate.
In Star Trek Online, anyway.
Speaking of Star Trek Online, do you want to say anything about the Klingons in Star Trek Online?
I think the Klingons are very much a mixed bag in Star Trek Online. They have definitely gone back to a philosophy of we are imperial, we're an empire, we're all about expanding that empire, and we don't really kind of care who's in our way with it. Now, that being said, a lot of the conflict that they're involved in has been either engineered or was a conflict that they have to fight. I mean, if you look at, did you read that book yet?
No, I haven't.
All right, so the Gorn attack a Klingon ship or freighter or something like that, and then that launches the Gorn hegemony and the Empire into a war with each other, which ends up with the Klingons taking over the Gorn hegemony and then also acquiring the Nausicaans and the Orions as part of their greater empire.
Right.
Is what it is. Now, this is also in the midst of them finding out that there's all these Species 8472 infiltrators everywhere, in which they find out that the Gorn King was a...
Oh dear.
Was a Species 8472. Now, I don't know if it's Undyne or Indian. I'm just going to call him a Species 8472 because I don't know how to say it. So they find out it's a Species 8472 infiltrator that was in charge of the whole Gorn like empire and whatnot. And that's probably what led them in this conflict in the first place. The whole thing was engineered. So this falls down a line of like the founders from Deep Space Nine where they have these, you know, pretty much shapeshifters going in, taking over personas of people that are important or are in key places at the right times to cause things to happen to then influence the rest of a conflict or so. And then later on we have, earlier than that, we have the Klingons taking over space that was Romulan space after the destruction of Romulus, because now the Romulans are scattering all that good stuff. I mean, that's a perfect opportunity for anybody to go in there and take Romulan space. Mm-hmm. Right, so they go in there, take a bunch of Romulus space, which some guy named Admiral Terrace manages to stop like their Klingon fleet from going any further and whatnot. But the Klingons kept the space or whatever.
Yeah,
and then we've got the Klingons declaring war on the Federation. Well, sort of declaring war on the Federation. I'm not sure if it's actually an openly declared state of war or not.
They're skirmishing is sort of the idea, the implication that I got.
Well, it definitely seems to be a full blown war, but it didn't really seem like anyone formally said, we're now at war or anything like that. Just kind of like conflict just happened.
Because
what happened is Chancellor Jempok, who actually killed Martok, by the way.
Right.
He challenged Martok to battle because he thought the Empire could be led differently and in a better way, a way that would make the Klingon Empire great once again, you know, all that good stuff. And not like necessarily bad or evil motivations, because if you go talk to Jempok in game, he actually seems like he's a pretty on-the-level kind of guy. Like, he doesn't seem like
he's but he killed Martok, so I hate him forever.
I don't know, it's 2409. Martok's kind of old and crusty at that point.
I don't give a crap. This guy's a jerk. He should respect his elders.
Yeah. But anyway, following this policy of expansionism and whatnot, the Klingons decide that they want to take back some colonies that are Federation colonies at this point. Specifically Korvat, some other places in the Arcanus sector that they want back and all that good stuff. The Federation is like, okay, no.
No, you can't have those.
And the Klingon fleet's going to come. And the Klingons give the Federation like a year or something like that to evacuate, or some amount of time. I don't know if it's months or a year. They come, and there's a Federation blockade of the planet, and that's when fighting just like starts, is what it is. So that's the actual point of hostilities, not necessarily declared hostilities, because they're just like, they're just fighting, you know, and when you wander around the game, it's like, yeah, we're totally at war with Klingons, but I can't point to any one instance where they finally say, yeah, we've declared war on such and such. So it's kind of like they just started shooting at each other is what it is.
Right.
Now, what has been speculated a lot on the forums, especially in Star Trek Online, is that species A472 are in fact influencing all of this conflict within the galaxy. Oh. Because we can point back to the Gorn conflict.
They did it once already.
Yeah, they did it once already. But they point to it that the Federation is what is infiltrated,
mm-hmm.
is what it is, and that the Klingon High Council is very aware of this, and they feel like the Klingon High Council has to go and root out a lot of the species A472 infiltrators.
Klingons have a bit of a complex with rooting out shape-shifting style entities, don't they?
They do, but I mean, with good reason, I feel. I mean, I feel like it's a good idea to perhaps get rid of people that aren't who they say they are.
I guess.
You know, when you've got enough evidence.
What are these infiltrators in the Federation supposedly doing? Since it sounds like all the Federation is doing is protecting its borders. Like, what are these infiltrators supposed to be doing as their leaders?
I don't know. I didn't get that far into the conversation, but a lot of it made sense to what the Klingons were doing. So not really bad guys in Star Trek Online or so. They're not being aggressive necessarily in a way that is making them to be just these horrible imperial expansionists. They're fighting because they feel they need to make sure the galaxy is safe, kind of like the Federation was in the days of old. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at how the story's been written in Star Trek Online, the Federation's at war with, like, I think no less than, like, 6 different factions right
Everyone's
now.
Everyone's at war with everybody in Star Trek Online, okay?
They are, and it's an MMO. It's, you know, combat focus is very much a focus in MMOs, which is really unfortunate in Star Trek Online's case. But as far as Klingons go in Star Trek Online, I feel like they were perhaps like Season 4 Klingons for Deep Space Nine,
mm-hmm.
but with a little more of a... Oh, what's the right word? What's the right phrase? Perhaps not so much of a... negative twist like we get in Deep Space Nine, because right. in Deep Space Nine it's very much like, hey, we're gonna go just take some Cardassian territory. You guys want to join us? Federation's like, no, not really. And then they sever ties and all that stuff with right. the Federation. It's very much more a, we're going to be an imperial expansionist society, but we're doing it because we feel it's really the only course available to us to ensure not only our survival, but to make sure that the galaxy, you know, remains as is.
Okay, now that you mentioned that, I want to touch on that real quick, on the way the Deep Space Nine had the Klingons, like, break their alliance with the Federation. I think that was really interesting because it, like, because you know how in TNG the Klingons were their friends.
Yep.
And then in Deep Space Nine, after a while, the Klingons became their enemies again, and that was an interesting little story arc that they did. And then the Klingons re-allied with them to fight the Dominion, which, and I think it was made very clear that the Klingons were... Like, I always felt that in both TOS and TNG, the Klingons were treated as kind of a monolithic block, even though they did have the Klingon Civil War story arc going in TNG. I do feel like it was always sort of taken as a granted that the Klingons were going to be the Federation's friends, unless the Klingons who were secretly being controlled by the Romulans took over. And then in DS9, it was made very clear that there are plenty of Klingon leaders who have different ideas for where the Empire should go, who aren't being controlled by outside forces.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, obviously, with Gowron as the Chancellor, the Klingon Empire is much more likely to be an enemy to the Federation than they are under Martok. And I especially like that because it tied back into the first episode where they were, like, deciding who was going to be the next Klingon Chancellor. They had their choice between Gowron and Duras. And,
Right. Like,
Worf even says that he doesn't really know anything about Gowron. And... So basically, they went with Gowron, who was a wild card, instead of going with Duras, who they knew was an ass. So it was like, you know, they didn't really know what they were going to get with Gowron. And it turned out that Gowron, once he was done solidifying his power base, decided he wanted to expand the Empire. And I thought that was, you know, really cool and kind of demonstrated the danger of putting a guy in power just because you don't like the other guy. you know, sometimes the guy you put there is also a jerk.
Yep.
You got to be careful with that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we are about out of time. I don't really think we... Like, there was some stuff... We were going to talk about Enterprise, but the Klingons in Enterprise are sort of... The biggest thing that Enterprise did with the Klingons was break their canon a bunch and be like, oh, so it turned out... Because, like, you know, I always assumed that the Klingons developed at about the same time as humans did. No. In Enterprise, we see that the Klingons are already, like, super high-tech as Earth is, like, barely, like, worming its way into space. And then at the same time that Kronos is apparently 4 days away from Earth at Warp 5.
right?
Yeah. And, like, there's also the... and then Enterprise also decided in the fourth season that they were going to explain why Klingons looked like humans in TOS. And they explained that it was, like, this failed attempt at an augment virus that turned into, like, a plague. which I honestly didn't feel like that needed an explanation. I thought that in Trials and Tribulations, they made that pretty clear that it was just an in-joke.
We don't discuss it with outsiders.
But you know, Enterprise is added to answer it. So, you know, what can I say? Anyway, so I think that's about all there is.
You have to think about the Batleth here, though.
Oh, well, yeah. I was going to just talk about some silly stuff with the Klingons. The Batleth is really silly. But I'm willing to forgive the Batleth because, like, if you talk to a props guy and are like, I need an alien sword, the props people are going to be like, okay. Because swords look the way that they do for a reason. Like, swords have been, you know, tested and re-engineered over, like, hundreds of years. And so it's very unlikely that the props department is going to be able to come up with a weird-looking but highly functional sword in, like, the month they have to come up with props. So their choices are to either go with a sword that looks like an Earth sword or to come up with something really funny-looking. And so they came up with the Batleth because it looks all weird and exotic. And even though, like, from a practical standpoint, it's, like, the worst weapon ever because it's a two-handed weapon that has no reach. And it's curved the wrong way, so it's, like, not entirely, you don't really get any kind of, even if you're two-handing it and holding it like a baseball bat with both hands on one side, it doesn't get a lot of reach because it's curved, and there's no clear striking surface. Because, like, even if the inside edge is sharp, it's going to be really hard to hit anyone with it. So, like, maybe you're supposed to hit them with the points, but that's really awkward because of the way they have to hold it. So, like, and I'm kind of miming you like a Batleth here, because I think we're being filmed, because I'm pro like that. But yeah, the Batleth is silly, but I'm willing to forgive it just because making props for sci-fi is hard. And as you can see, with the Klingon knife, they went the much lazier route, and it's just a knife. Like, there's really
the two little things that flip out.
Yeah, well, it's a butterfly knife then. I mean, there's nothing special about that. And then they have the Mechleth, which is basically just half of a Batleth. And it's, like, sort of the same.
Maybe the Kukri.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's a
way more curved.
It's a little more practical because it's got the curved inside, but it's one-handed. It's not meant to be used with two hands, so it looks a little bit less dumb. But it's, you know, whatever. I'm willing to forgive the Batleth just because they have to make something that looks alien. And then, like, there's also just the fact that Klingons, when they're played wrong, come off as being really goofy. And we already talked about the prosthetics, how, like, some actors just can't talk through their prosthetic teeth.
just bothers me so much.
Yeah. But overall, I really like the Klingons. They've clearly become a cultural phenomenon. Like, most people know what a Klingon is to some extent.
You can learn the Klingon language.
You can.
In a university or something.
It's a real language. You can have, like, you know, I mean, it's a constructed language, so it's almost more of a cipher of English than a language, but it works as one, and, like, you can, you know, if you learn Klingon, there's really nothing you can't say in Klingon that you could say in English. Like, you know, there have been numerous works of Shakespeare translated into Klingon, you know, for fun times, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Klingons, I'm really expecting there to be Klingons in the next Star Trek movie. I'm hoping it will be a good Star Trek movie about Klingons, but we'll see.
Everybody keeps saying the next Trek movie is going to, hands down, be Star Trek 2, you know, Khan's,
you know, introduction. I don't know where you keep hearing this, because I've never seen this anywhere.
Every article I read, I mean, keep in mind, I get a lot of my stuff from Dig.com. I just go peruse random articles about, you know, just random stuff, which is typically what I post on Facebook anyway. I don't actually use Facebook for a whole lot of stuff, other than posting, hey, there's this really cool article I found. But a lot of the articles I find in relation to Star Trek, the next Star Trek movie is, oh yeah, it's going to totally be about Khan. I don't know where they get their information, mind you. A lot of it's just rumor and conjecture. All I can tell you is that it's going to be another Star Trek movie that J.J. Abrams is going to do. It's going to have all the same
I really
cast.
Hope it's not about Khan.
And I know that, at least I think I know, that the RoboCop guy is going to be in it.
Yeah, I did hear
the
that.
The original RoboCop movie.
All right. But okay, so now we're talking
about
it's
a rumor, again. I don't have anything to substantiate that, so don't take what I say as, you know, completely true.
All right, well, now we're talking about Star Trek, which is not what... I mean, about no. Star Trek. Okay, we're talking about Star Trek the movie, which is not what we wanted. So anyway, I'm going to close this out. Klingons are awesome. I love Klingons. And with that, thank you for listening.
Happy New Year!